Good morning. Walmart's CEO says its stockpile of pre-tariff products is running out and the cost to buy new stuff is rising every week. How are major retailers passing on those costs to consumers? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump appointed his former personal lawyer to be the top prosecutor in New Jersey as an interim U.S. attorney. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. A federal judge now says she stayed on too long and she should be disqualified from cases. Also, what to watch for in this year's U.S. Open with a record $5 million top prize. It's Friday, August 22nd. On this day in 2004, The Scream, the painting by Edvard Munch, was stolen from a Norwegian museum. A different version was stolen from a different museum 10 years earlier. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. A UN-backed panel of experts on starvation has declared that northern Gaza is now suffering from a full-blown famine. The panel says 500,000 people there are facing, quote, catastrophic conditions. As NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Tel Aviv, this comes after almost 2 years of war and Israeli restrictions on relief aid entering the devastated territory.
The report by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, says 500,000 people in Gaza are facing the most severe level of hunger crisis, characterized by starvation, destitution, and death. It also warns that another 1 million people, about half the population of Gaza, are facing severe food deprivation, and that more than 130,000 children under the age of 5 are at risk of death from acute malnutrition in the coming year. The IPC does not assign blame. Israel has denied there's a hunger crisis in Gaza and has restricted food and medicine going into Gaza, saying Hamas steals them and uses them for its own purposes. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
California state lawmakers have passed a measure that would create a method to redraw the state's congressional districts. The goal is to flip 5 Republican congressional districts to Democratic control and send the Democrats to the U.S. House of Representatives. California Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom has signed the measure. He says California is responding to Texas Republicans who are trying to flip 5 congressional seats in that state to GOP control.
Open your eyes to what is going on in the United States of America in 2025. That's what this is about. We're responding to what occurred in Texas.
Texas state senators are considering a similar effort. They haven't yet passed their GOP redistricting plan, but they are expected to do so very soon. Hurricane Erin is pulling deeper into the Atlantic Ocean and away from North America. It never made landfall. But NPR's Matt Bloom reports officials on the East Coast are still warning of dangerous conditions.
Erin's eye remains hundreds of miles off the East Coast, but many places are still feeling it. New Jersey's governor has declared a state of emergency due to 50-mile-per-hour gusts and 17-foot waves. In Virginia, power companies are warning residents not to touch downed lines. Azaria Hochstedler is with Dominion Energy.
Keep away from those power lines. Sometimes you might see them fall, like come down into the driveway. Avoid it at all costs. Stay inside.
High surf and flood warnings remain in effect along much of the New England coastline. Erin, now one of the largest Atlantic storms on record, is expected to weaken as it moves northeast away from land. Matt Bloom, NPR News.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, futures are higher. This is NPR. California officials have denied parole to Eric Menendez. He's one of two brothers convicted of murdering their parents more than 30 years ago in a case that drew a lot of attention. Steve Futterman reports from San Diego.
The board met for nearly 10 hours, hearing testimony from Eric Menendez and others, including his supporters and relatives, who urged the board to recommend release. The L.A. County District Attorney's Office also took part, arguing against any release. In announcing the decision, Commissioner Robert Barton said, "I believe in redemption, but believe you pose a continued risk to public safety." He acknowledged the sexual abuse suffered by Menendez at the hands of his father. However, he said there were other things he could have done, including reaching out to police. Eric Menendez can next appear before a parole board in 3 years. On Friday, his brother Lyle will have his hearing. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in San Diego.
Federal Reserve Board Chair Jerome Powell will give a major speech today. He'll be attending a key meeting of economists and central bankers in Wyoming. President Trump has been pressuring Powell and the Fed to lower short-term interest rates. Powell's speech will be scrutinized for any clues about the Fed's thinking. Entertainment company Sony says it will sharply increase the price of its popular gaming consoles, the PlayStation 5. The price is going up by $50. The cheapest PlayStation console will now be about $500. Sony says it's trying to navigate a challenging economic environment. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Visit St. Pete, Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
In 1905, William Williams was convicted of murdering a St. Paul teen and his mother. In 1906, he was sentenced to die by hanging. This was Minnesota's last execution because a botched hanging made public by aggressive news reporting shifted public opinion. At the time, the press was banned from covering executions due to the John Day Smith Law, frequently called the Midnight Assassination Law. It required private nighttime execution of prisoners in order to banish crowds. Reporter Joseph Hennessy, writing for the St. Paul Daily News, snuck in and witnessed the gruesome hanging and wrote about William's agonizing death.
The sheriff had miscalculated the length of the rope, and so William Williams fell through the scaffold trap. His feet hit the floor, and it took about 14 minutes for him to die by strangulation.
That's historian Michael Anderson, detailing what should have been an instant death. Despite this ban on reporting, the St. Paul Pioneer Press, the St. Paul Dispatch, and the St. Paul Daily News carried the story with the gory details. The newspapers were fined $25 each, but the accounts were enough to cause public outcry over capital punishment. And in 1911, lawmakers outlawed the practice.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. Are prices rising because of tariffs?
This week, we heard an answer from some of the largest retailers in America, including Walmart, Home Depot, and Target.
NPR's Alina Selyuk has been listening to those companies' earnings calls and is here in studio with her takeaways. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so what's the answer? What have the big retailers been saying?
Many are acknowledging that they are indeed raising some prices because of tariffs, but they are really playing it cool. Like, it's pretty minor for now. It is worth noting there is a bit of a political context here. Back in May, when Walmart issued a pretty clear warning that tariffs would lead to higher prices in a matter of weeks, President Trump posted online in all caps that Walmart should stop blaming tariffs and, quote, eat the tariffs. Mm. So now big retailers are giving us more measured and nuanced takes. Home Depot, for example, has been saying no broad-based price hikes were happening, but some prices are up. Some items are getting switched out on shelves, that sort of thing.
Okay, so they're playing it cool, but are companies doing what Trump said they should, eating the tariffs?
Oh, definitely. We saw car makers go this route. For example, General Motors took more than $1 billion in tariff costs as a hit to profits. Mm-hmm. Many big retailers also spread the pain and made their suppliers eat some of the cost in addition. But the main thing that many retailers have been doing is stockpiling. Companies from Target to dollar stores to Home Depot, they all brought in to the U.S. as much as they reasonably could before tariffs kicked in. And now Walmart CEO Doug McMillon told investors this week pretty pointedly that these stockpiles are running out.
But as we replenish inventory at post-tariff price levels, we've continued to see our costs increase each week, which we expect will continue into the third and fourth quarters.
Okay, it may not sound that pointed, but this is quite direct for corporate speak. He's saying the cost for Walmart to replenish its supplies is getting pricier by the week.
Okay, so that seems to suggest higher prices aren't here yet, but they're coming. Is that influencing shoppers at all?
On this, I can cite Walmart CEO McMillan again. He said tariffs took so long to roll out that shoppers have not changed their behavior in any dramatic way yet.
Okay.
People, especially with higher incomes, seem to be feeling spendy. For example, take furniture. It was fairly quickly affected by tariffs. Prices went up. People bought less of it. But then in July, federal data showed people bought more furniture again.
Interesting.
With cars and trucks, right now auto sales are going strong thanks to car prices that have stayed pretty steady. But it also, I think, feels a bit like suspended reality. It's all being propped up by wage gains of recent years and what had been a strong labor market. But we've started to get some economic indicators showing cracks in the jobs market. And inflation, of course, has been chipping away at the wages buying power. All of this, by the way, is in focus today because of a big speech by Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. He's giving his final appearance as Fed chair in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. But the biggest question hanging over this is how long until companies decide they cannot afford to eat the tariffs anymore?
And really quickly, what's the answer?
Probably not forever. And imagine shoppers know this, which is why Home Depot says right now the number one thing that still keeps people from spending more is economic uncertainty.
NPR's Alina Selyuk. Thanks, Alina.
Thank you.
Given all this, we're going to zoom out a bit for a broader look at the U.S. economy. We called Mary Lovely for this. She's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research institution. She's with us now. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
So we just heard Alina talk about companies like Walmart warning of higher prices due to President Trump's tariffs. How significant is that warning, and what do you think it means for the economy?
Well, I think it's very significant. And Walmart, of course, is a place where you find a lot of traded goods. And we're seeing enormous pressure on the prices of traded goods because of President Trump's tariffs.
Traded goods being?
Anything that we import in large quantities and their domestic substitutes, because domestic prices rise when foreign prices rise, because U.S. producers are able to expand, and they do so to fill in the gap.
And what does it mean for the economy?
For the economy, it means that we're probably facing higher inflation. We saw last month, actually August, that consumers view the inflation that's ahead of them as higher than what the Fed would like. It rose to 4.9%. So consumers are feeling this. They don't see their wages keeping up. And people are starting to worry, how are they going to handle these price increases moving forward?
And just briefly, if a big retailer like Walmart, with presumably a lot of buying power in the marketplace, is saying it can't absorb all the tariff costs forever, what does that say about smaller businesses and how they might be able to cope?
Well, many small businesses are hit in two ways. Some of them will see higher prices because domestic competition, you know, is hindered by the tariffs. But for many of them, they're seeing the prices of the goods they use to produce go up. So, for example, if you're a small boat manufacturer and you import the electric motor that goes in your boat, you're going to see that electric motor price increase. Or if you make knitted supplies, you're going to see the price of wool and other goods go up. So small businesses actually have been telling reporters for quite some time that the tariffs are hurting them.
So do you think that we are at an inflection point in the economy? And if so, what data points would you be looking at to determine that?
Yeah, I believe that Alina said we're in suspended reality. We're on the verge of something. We're not quite sure what it will be. I think this is the problem that's facing the Fed. GDP growth was a little higher in the second quarter of this year, but overall for 2025, it's pretty anemic. It's 1.2%. Imports have fallen, exports have fallen, prices are up, uncertainty is way, way up. We're seeing consumers, particularly at the lower end of the income distribution, really struggling. Interestingly, about 15% of all home sales agreements were canceled last month. That's very high. It suggests that people become very uncertain when they're trying to make big spending decisions about whether they'll have the income to support that spending. About a quarter of all student loans are late or in default. So many people are beginning to experience real struggles with their income. Employment is stalled. So people don't see that their job prospects are steady, have confidence that they're going to remain employed. The economy starts to sputter.
You know, President Trump campaigned on the promise to lower prices for Americans. And, you know, some prices have come down But what's your assessment overall of the reality of what his policies or the impact of his policies on prices?
Well, one of the big prices that's come down is energy, and energy prices are very volatile. They go up, they go down all the time. The Fed often looks at what's called the core CPI, which strips out energy and food prices, and that was up 3.1% in July. So we are seeing pressure on prices. The producer price index, which, you know, catalogs what happens with the prices that producers pay, was up 3.3%. So there is concern about prices going up. At the same time, there's these pressures, which I noted earlier, about jobs and GDP. So as the Fed is considering what to do with interest rates, they have to realize that they have its dual mandate to maintain price stability and to keep the economy growing. And yet those two things are out of sync right now. There is a fear of what we have called, for those of us who were alive in the 1970s, stagflation, where the economy fails to grow or even falls into recession. And at the same time, we see inflation ticking up. So most economists don't see a recession on the near horizon, but it seems pretty hard to not look at the data and conclude that the economy is really starting to slow.
Yeah.
And that's why people say it's an inflection point.
So before we let you go, we only have about 30 seconds left, but the Fed Chair Jerome Powell is speaking to economists and central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming today. What are you going to be listening for?
Well, everybody, of course, will be hanging on his words about the state of the economy and if he throws some hints as to which way the Fed is leaning in terms of these interest rate cuts that are widely expected. But we will also look to see whether he talks about the need for accurate economic data, where people will remember that President Trump fired the chief labor statistic, and then also whether he'll talk about Fed independence from political pressure.
That is Mary Lovely. She's a senior fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Mary Lovely, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Vice President Vance Hello. Was in Georgia on Thursday to promote the administration's sweeping tax and spending bill signed into law last month. As NPR's Stephen Fowler reports, the law is becoming a campaign talking point ahead of the midterms.
Speaking at an industrial refrigeration equipment manufacturer in a suburb south of Atlanta, the vice president said the legislation was reflective of a, quote, government that stands up for you instead of fights against you.
Because we believe that you ought to keep more of your hard-earned money, and we believe that if you're busting your rear end every single day, the government ought to make it easier for you and not harder for you.
Polls suggest voters have a chilly reaction to many key provisions of the law, which shifts resources away from the social safety net toward the tax cuts, increased immigration enforcement, and other Trump administration priorities. Still, Vance used the speech to attack Georgia Democratic Senator John Ossoff, who's one of the most vulnerable senators on the ballot in 2026, for opposing the measure.
In about a year, you are not going to be able to turn on the television without Senator John Ossoff pretending that he supported the working families tax cut when in reality he voted against it.
Speaking ahead of Vance's visit, Ossoff called it, quote, embarrassing that Vance would tout legislation that Ossoff said is already harming hospitals like Evans Memorial in southeast Georgia.
They're going to have a $3.5 million financial hole next year. That hospital here in Georgia is now warning that they may have to cut the ICU.
The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates the law could cause more than 10 million people to lose health coverage, bring in less income for the bottom 10% of Americans, and run a deficit of $3.4 trillion over the next 10 years. Both Democrats and Republicans indicate the tax cuts and other policies approved by the GOP-controlled Congress will play a prominent role in 2026 midterm messaging, though some changes would not take effect until after that election. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Peachtree City, Georgia.
This is NPR News.
KEXE was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town, and it magically became a, there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KEXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We're in crisis mode. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
Turn your radio on, turn your radio on.
Comes from this station. And from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. The U.S. Open begins this weekend, so who seems poised to win this year's tennis tournament and its record-setting prize money? Joining us for a preview is John Wertheim with Sports Illustrated. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what are you following in this year's tournament?
Great question. This is the fourth major, so this is the last shot for these players. I mean, on the men's side, this Carlos Alcaraz-Yannick Sinner rivalry has sort of become the new Federer-Nadal-Djokovic. It's sort of those two are the main candidates, and everyone else is sort of a write-in. And then on the women's side, Iga Świątek, this sort of talented player from Poland, had a bit of a slip earlier this season, but then she won Wimbledon and now suddenly looks like the player to beat.
So those are the players to watch?
Three among many, but yes.
Whoever comes out on top is going to win the largest prize money in tennis history. How much money are we talking about here?
The winner gets $5 million. On the other hand, this is now a 15-day sporting event that draws record crowds, and the tickets aren't inexpensive. So as a function of revenue, I would say the players, the $5 million sounds like a lot of money, but this is an event that brings in a lot of money as well.
It does sound like a lot of money. With that high of a prize, does it change or influence the tournament at all?
I think, to the top players, they all do very well in their lives. But I think what's really significant is that the first round prize money. So if you and I played and didn't win a single point, but were in the first round, we would still make $110,000. Wow. And I think in a way, it's sort of the prize money at the lower levels, at the lower rounds, that almost has more impact than the winner getting this check for $5 million.
I can confirm that if I played, I would not make a single point. Pretty sure that's... So what about predictions for you this weekend?
I'm interested in seeing Coco Gauff, who won the French Open, talented young American player, but she just changed coaches on the eve of the tournament, which we don't see very often, and now is working with a new sort of biomechanical coach. She won the U.S. Open 2 years ago, has struggled a bit the last few months, so it's sort of this interesting point where she is this great champion. She's already won a major title this year at Paris at Roland Garros, and yet she's really struggling. And then on the men's side, can anyone crack this duopoly between Alcaraz and Sinner, who have won each of the last seven majors?
Jonathan Wertheim with Sports Illustrated. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Time now for StoryCorps. Next week marks 20 years since Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast. Skip Beaux witnessed the start of the storm from his home in Lakeview, New Orleans.
The wind started picking up 50, 60 miles an hour. Then it gets past 100 miles an hour. And then patio furniture is passing in front of your face and people's porches are going by. And then all of a sudden, water just gushed in. I went upstairs to look out the window. Lo and behold, there's a fishing boat floating by. So I jumped out the window into the water and swam toward the boat, tied it off, and I said, I'm going to deal with this in the morning. I took the comforter off of the bed, laid it on the roof. That was my bed for the night. I just thought I was the only idiot that stayed. And then I heard, can you help me? And I shouted, I'll get you tomorrow, right now. Can't do anything at nighttime. The next day, I proceeded to go get the Drakes who lived on the corner. They was probably in their 80s. She was totally out of it with Alzheimer's. They had made it to the attic. And then I heard my other neighbor calling me, and I kept yelling to him, I'm coming to you next, Luke. He's just lived with his sister, who was bedridden. And when I pulled up, you could walk on his roof. The boat was gutter high. And I said, Luke, it's Skip, but he doesn't want to come out the attic. He says, don't you come down here. You killed my sister. And I said, no, I didn't, Luke. He goes, well, she's downstairs. Why didn't you save me last night? Get out of here. And I think he lost it when he saw his sister got swallowed by water. Meanwhile, Mr. Drake's in the boat yelling, I have to bring my wife to the hospital. I said, Luke, look, I'm coming back. Hang in there. So I left. And then I dropped them off to higher ground. That's when I said I have to get back to get my buddy that I left. And when I got back to Luke, he was dead in the attic. I cried, second-guessed myself. I made a decision. I picked the oldest ones first, thinking they were the weakest ones, leaving the strong to survive. And it didn't work out that way. Months after, I was totally beating myself up. But later on, I was cutting the grass. And the Drakes that were on the corner, their daughter passed by and said, I think you saved my parents. I said, yes, ma'am, I did. She goes, you gave them 3 more years. I just wanted to tell you thank you. And then I realized why I stayed during the storm, you know. What was the meaning of me staying? And at least I know I did the best that a person could have done.
That's Skip Bowe in New Orleans. His StoryCorps interview is archived at the Library of Congress. And let me mention, we will be in New Orleans next week reporting on the aftermath of Katrina 20 years later.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial. For many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. And from Subaru, who along with its retailers is partnering with AdoptAClassroom.org to provide funding to high-need schools and local communities for the Subaru Loves Learning Initiative. Subaru, more than a car company.
This is NPR News.
When schools finally reopened after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans 20 years ago, many of the city's veteran educators were replaced by young out-of-towners.
The people that did come down, they were well-meaning, but they weren't trained.
I'm Juana Summers. We hear from opposite sides of that teacher divide on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock this afternoon here on People Powered KAXE. Your local host is Andrew DeZingle. It is 5:29. Thanks for listening to the Friday morning show. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a few moments, John Latimer has his daily dose of phenology, looking back at this date in his Nature Notes, August 22nd. Patchy fog early this morning, gradually becoming partly cloudy by this afternoon. Highs in the upper 70s to low 80s. Winds from the west, northwest, 10 to 20 miles per hour. Mostly clear overnight, lows in the mid-50s. And for tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs in the mid to upper 60s. And breezy northwest winds, slight chance for showers. Looking ahead to Sunday, chance of showers, especially in the afternoon, partly sunny, highs in the mid-60s. Again, breezy northwest winds. The Babinski Foundation is offering a pet adoption event today from noon to 4 at Fleet Farm in Baxter. Meet dogs and cats of all ages who would love to join your family. And the Saks Zimbog near Meadowlands invites you to a reception for their artists in residence today from 1 to 4 at the Lois King Education Center. These artists will focus on bog diversity and the importance of peatlands. This weekend on Stay Human, we'll hear about a pop-up art show that happened last week, Words as Buried Seeds. We'll hear from the organizers and others about that scene. That is tomorrow morning at 9 and Sunday at 5 p.m. The Hubbard County Historical Society invites you to an opening celebration for the new Park Rapids History Trail. That is today from 1 to 3. The trail tells the story of Park Rapids through 23 different sites. Find more info at prhistorytrail.org. Let us know what's going on in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org.
On today's date, August 22nd, 1984, I see my first ever bobcat in the wild. Bobcats are remarkably stealthy and seldom are seen out in the open. This one dashed across the road in front of me and left an irreplaceable image in my head of a large cat, short tail, somewhat the color of a deer, kind of grayish, reddish, and moving very quickly. In the intervening years, trail cams have become very popular across northern Minnesota, well, and across the country in general. And one of the repeated images seen on trail cams are bobcats. They're much more ubiquitous than we ever thought. There seem to be bobcats behind every tree and under every pile of rocks. And the trail cam has brought it out to all of us. But they are very stealthy and mostly running around at night, so we seldom see them, and any sound that we would make would tip them off in a hurry to get the heck out of there. So not many get seen, but there are many around.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The fight President Trump started for control of Congress is fully underway. The Texas Senate plans to vote on a redistricting map today. It's a plan that's already passed the House there and would give Republicans the edge on five more seats.
And California is reacting. The Democratic governor there, Gavin Newsom, posted "It's on" on social media Wednesday. He signed two bills passed by the Democratic-led legislature Thursday that would pave the way to a redistricting plan of their own, one that would give Democrats the edge on more seats in the House. But that's only if California voters approve it in a special election.
Laura Fitzgerald is a political reporter with CAP Radio in Sacramento who has been following this story. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
Okay, so now that the governor and the legislature have gotten their work on this plan done, what are you watching for next?
Well, California's redistricting process is going to look a lot different than how it looks in Texas. Here, we have an independent commission of citizens that redraws political lines instead of politicians. So voters here have to decide whether we can bypass that commission through 2030 and let this new map, which has been drawn to the Democratic advantage, take effect. And as you mentioned, Leila, the Texas proposal, Republicans advanced their own mid-decade map and the House approved it this week. The Senate is expected to take it up Friday, and it does appear that that's going to pass.
And when do voters in California decide whether they'll allow this?
November 4th. That is when Governor Gavin Newsom is called for the special election. Now that this proposal is out of the legislature's hands, Democrats here have to convince voters to vote to let them carry out this redistricting plan. The governor even talked about that at a press conference yesterday.
We have a lot more work to do. Get this done November 4th.
And that happened almost immediately after he signed the bills yesterday. Newsom and other Democrats went straight to the state Democratic Party headquarters near the Capitol in Sacramento to hold a press event for the campaign side of things.
Okay, so that's what Democrats are doing and saying in California. What about Republicans?
I've heard a lot of Republicans say that they want to get out and campaign against this measure. They've already tried to sue. That was blocked by court. They could try again, but across the board, this new map could really shake things up. Republican representatives in these redrawn congressional districts will face much more difficult re-elections in 2026. But ultimately, this map could mean California's Republican delegation to the U.S. House is just four people.
Do you have any sense of how voters might vote on this issue?
Well, there's a mix of polling out there right now and even more underway, but it's still very early. I actually asked Matt Rexrode this exact question. He's a Republican political consultant and redistricting expert here in California. He told me the special election is about a lot more than redrawn lines.
This election is not going to be decided on redistricting. I personally love redistricting. I wish people would talk about it all the time. But the issue that voters are going to vote on in this election will be, do you support President Trump or do you support Gavin Newsom?
Rexrode here, he's referring to the fact that Newsom is widely seen as someone who might have national aspirations. So as this campaign develops over the coming weeks, it'll be really interesting to see what kind of political tone this redistricting measure takes on, both with California politicians and with voters.
Laura Fitzgerald, political reporter with CAP Radio in Sacramento. Thank you for your reporting, Laura.
Thank you, Leila.
A federal judge has ruled that one of President Trump's former personal attorneys, appointed as New Jersey's top federal prosecutor back in March, has been in that position without legal authority for several weeks. Alina Haba was supposed to be an interim U.S. attorney by law that's supposed to mean a 120-day limit to her term. A panel of federal judges picked a veteran prosecutor to start leading the office last month, but Attorney General Pam Bondi fired that prosecutor and Haba has stayed on. Now, U.S. District Judge Matthew Brand has said Haba should be disqualified from all active cases. Journalist Rai Rivard has been following this story for Politico, and he's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
How did Haba manage to stay in this position so long?
The Trump administration used this multi-step process after her four-month interim stay expired. They fired the prosecutor you talked about, who was selected by a panel of judges. Then they named Haba a special attorney. Then she became the first assistant attorney, which then allowed her to become the acting U.S. attorney. And that's what the court was asked to examine. And so far, one judge has said, you can't do that.
So the judge delayed his own order in this decision to let the government respond. Has the government responded?
Yeah, Attorney General Pam Bondi said last evening on Thursday night that they would immediately appeal. That will go to the Third Circuit. There are some interesting questions that, you know, if the Third Circuit decision is appealed, you know, the Supreme Court would take a look at.
So given that there's this a little uncertainty here, how much could this affect criminal cases in New Jersey, especially now that the judge has said her actions of the last several weeks may be declared void?
There, he was looking at just a couple of defendants who had filed kind of complaints and lawsuits saying, hey, you know, Hava can't be involved in our case. His formal order only applies to them, but the ruling that he had applies to basically every criminal case in New Jersey that's a federal criminal case. And so you can expect to see a lot of people saying, hey, this affects me, hey, this affects me. And the judge said, the person that Trump put in charge of this office can't be involved in running the office. So that's a big wrench in how you'd run a U.S. attorney's office.
So what are they doing? I guess are they still trying cases? Are they putting somebody else's name on the cases? Or how is this working?
Yeah, we've seen the number two of the Justice Department, Todd Blanche, starting to kind of co-sign some of the legal filings. And we think that might be a way that the Justice Department thinks it can keep going while there's this uncertainty around Hava's authority to sort of muddle through in the meantime.
Do you have any sense of what this ruling could mean for other appointees in other states where the Trump administration has tried to sidestep Senate confirmation for prosecutors?
Yeah, we've seen this happen in Los Angeles. We've seen it in Nevada, New York, and upstate New York, New Mexico and upstate New York, where the administration has tried to find ways around these limits and around having to have a Senate-confirmed person running a U.S. attorney's office. There's about 93 U.S. attorneys nationwide. And so if what happened for Hava could happen in other places, you could really see an undermining of the Senate's typical authority, which is advice and consent in who gets to run these offices, who is the top prosecutor.
That is political reporter Rai Rivard. Rai, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Thank you for listening to the Friday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 5:42. Headwaters Music and Arts in Bemidji has a drum workshop and circle jam tonight from 5:30 to 8:30, free and open to those ages 10 and up. Learn from two renowned teachers of West African drumming, and you can listen to our conversation about that from Wednesday's morning show at our website, kaxe.org. Also happening this evening, the Eveleth Elks Club has a corn feed and classic car show that's happening from 4:30 to 7 at the corner of Grant Avenue in Jones Street. Proceeds benefit the Elks Youth Scholarship Fund. And you can learn about Dutch oven cooking at Lake Bemidji State Park tomorrow at 1:30 in the afternoon. Meet at the fire ring by the dining hall. Seasoned chefs and outdoor enthusiasts will teach you how to care for a Dutch oven, and you'll also get to enjoy some tasty treats. Coming up at about 7:45 this morning, what's for breakfast, when we get to know one of our members and chat with you a bit. You can let us know if you'd like to be on that program today. Text in 218-326-1234. We'd love to hear from you. The Native American Music and Arts Festival is coming up Sunday, August 31st from 10 to 5 at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post near Onamia. There will be artist demonstration, live music, and food trucks.
Join us for the 5th Annual Grand Rapids River Fest, Saturday, September 6th, presented by KAXE, the City of Grand Rapids, and sponsored by Grand Rapids State Bank. The lineup features Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Come along for a day of great music along the banks of the Mississippi River. Tickets available now at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Good.
Good morning. I'm Leila Faldin. When a bunch of steaks are on fire, that's usually a sign of a delicious time, unless you're a vegetarian. Now, that wasn't the case in Missouri earlier this week. A truck carrying 40,000 pounds of ribeye steak caught fire on the highway. A team of firefighters, including a vegan, responded. Probably a nightmare assignment for her, but she and the team got that fire out. The fire department says the steaks, though, were a total loss. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of business management software with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Betterment, an automated investing platform that strives to make it easy to be invested. Learn more at betterment.com. Investing involves risk. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. President Trump has replaced the grass in the iconic White House Rose Garden with stone. It's a nearly $2 million project and just the latest of many modifications Trump is making to the White House. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports.
Since returning to the White House in January, President Trump has been on a mission to renovate. And that includes the Rose Garden. By Trump's telling, getting rid of the grass was a necessity because it got too soggy in the rain. Here he was in an interview with The Spectator magazine in February.
We had the press here yesterday. You see the women, they're going crazy. The grass was wet. Their heels are going right through the grass like 4 inches deep.
Wearers of stilettos need not worry about sinking anymore. The grass has been replaced with gleaming white stone. New drainage systems are covered with white grates with a stars and stripes motif.
And it's a beautiful white stone, and it's a stone that's the same color as the White House itself. And because it's very white, it's going to reflect the heat. It's not going to be very hot, like if you had a dark stone. So, yeah, we've gotten great reviews on the Rose Garden.
The Rose Garden, with the large lawn in the center edged by flower beds, dates back to the Kennedy administration.
The garden is filled with some of your old friends from the Congress.
At this 1963 event, President John F. Kennedy gave comedian Bob Hope a congressional medal. Kennedy is the one who made it less of a garden and more of an event space. Stuart McLaren is president of the White House Historical Association.
President Kennedy wanted an outdoor room. He wanted a space where you could have outdoor meetings, receptions, events.
The garden remained largely unchanged until the first Trump term, when First Lady Melania Trump led an effort to restore it. She added drainage, hedges, and 200 new rose bushes. Trump recently boasted about the blooms when introducing his wife at an event.
You know, she took a lot of heat. She did it. It was so gorgeous, and these people couldn't do that if they tried. And those flowers were blooming. I said, how the hell? Two weeks ago, this was like beautiful green, but it was nothing. And now it just happened so quickly. But you did some job.
Those flowers aren't going anywhere. Only the grass was removed. The $1.9 million price tag is being covered by private donations to the Trust for the National Mall, which also paid for the earlier overhaul. And while the First Lady was a driving force last time, this project is all President Trump. Earlier this week, music blasted from the White House as Trump tested out a new speaker system for the deck. Trump can play DJ from his iPad, just like he does at Mar-a-Lago, his Florida resort. The Rose Garden also has patio tables now with yellow and white striped umbrellas, a perfect match to the space at Mar-a-Lago known as the Beach Club. McLaren acknowledges this change may be jarring, but he says many changes at the White House that were controversial at the time have become essential parts of the People's House. The West Wing, the Colonnade, the North and South Porticos, all of those were add-ons.
It's not frozen in time. It evolves and it changes, and different presidents and first ladies have different ideas.
And Trump has had many different ideas. There are plans to add a ballroom, and the Oval Office is now thoroughly gilded. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
In the past, we knew more about our neighbors. I'm Heidi Holton, and KEXC provides that. We get to know the people that live in northern Minnesota, like Kathy Davies on What's for Breakfast.
Well, truly, every day I wake up with you guys, and so there's socialization. And I love the local news. That interview with Amy Klobuchar this morning was wonderful. I am so supportive of finding out what's going on with all the tribal stations, and I care about the Canadian wildfires. I love to hear about everything that's local. You know, I've been to Riverfest, and that was fantastic. I listen to and support KAXE because you guys are what it's all about up here.
When you donate to KEXE, you're supporting your local community. Help us out now during this crisis of the defunding of public media from the federal government. Thank you for being there for KEXE. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
The fashion world has the annual Met Gala, the movies have the Oscars, Central Banking has the annual gathering in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is currently looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who are interested in building a career and joining an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
From Marketplace, I'm Nova Safo in for David Brancaccio. That gathering in Jackson Hole is on now, and Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is scheduled to make his final appearance as chair, delivering a speech in front of economists and central bankers from around the world. As always, we'll be listening for hints on the direction of interest rates, especially amid a White House pressure campaign to lower them. But there's another issue looming over Powell's speech, the Fed's framework for setting policies to keep inflation in check and the job market healthy. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more on that framework and how it might change.
Every 5 years, the Fed makes a plan, just like Stalinist countries used to do. Theirs were focused on every detail of the economy. The Fed, it's just trying to figure out how to accomplish its dual mandate of stable prices and maximum employment. Ellen Mead is a former Fed economist, now at Duke. She says when Fed officials issued the first framework in 2012,
they kept talking about it as a constitution.
For the first time, central bank officials set 2% as their inflation target. They didn't establish a specific number for unemployment. But a few years later, inflation was stuck below 2%. So Mead says in 2020, Fed officials made a big edit.
We're going to say that when we've been really underrunning 2%, we're going to try to make up for it by running inflation a bit above 2% for a while so that we average out at 2%.
But as anyone who's been to a grocery store lately knows, inflation is now stuck stubbornly above 2%. That 2020 framework established when low inflation was a problem, it's outdated. Fed Chair Powell is expected to unveil a new framework in his speech today. Former Fed economist Claudia Somm is now with New Century Advisors.
The big edits we see are going to, in all likelihood, be undoing the big edits we saw in 2020.
Because now, she says, we have stubborn inflation, but nobody knows if we'll see a resurgence of low inflation. So the Fed has to be flexible. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. Well, global markets are pointing every which way ahead of Powell's speech. The FTSE in London is flat. The Shanghai Composite Index rose 1.5%. Wall Street yesterday closed lower for the fifth straight day. This morning, Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are pointing up in the 2-3% range, with the Dow future up about 160 points. The 10-year Treasury yield is up slightly above 4.7%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering a small ship experience with a shore excursion included in every port and onboard cultural enrichment. Discover more at Viking.com. And by This Old House Radio Hour podcast, answering listeners' DIY and renovation questions and diving into home design trends, available in podcast apps.
The housing market remains stuck amid high mortgage rates. Home sales are hovering near a 30-year low, even with more inventory coming online. Aside from those high rates, there's also broader economic uncertainty keeping people on the sidelines. There is one bright spot, new evidence that first-time homebuyers remain undeterred. For more on this, David Brancaccio spoke with Marketplace's senior economics contributor, Chris Farrell.
So it can be done. People who've never owned a house can buy a home. There are actual examples of this occurring?
Yes, there are. Look, David, first-time homebuyers, they're a resilient group, and that word resilient, it's favored by economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and they did this intriguing series of studies on first-time homebuyers, and the economists document that the share of purchase mortgages by first-time homebuyers, as well as their share of home purchases, increased slightly in recent years.
Are they sure? I pay attention to this, and I recall contradictory data showing first-timers are especially having trouble buying. Why the turnabout?
Data, David. Data. Now, you're right. National Association of Realtors, they previously reported that first-time homebuyers represented only 24% of home sales between July of 2023 and June of 2024. And that figure, it was disturbing. It was the lowest in the history of the Realtors data going back to 1981. And obviously, the figure generated dismay that the dream of homeownership for millions of renters was fading.
So the New York Fed economists come in, they take a second look, and what do they find?
Well, they take a really deep dive into the data, and they say, look, here's the thing. The National Association of Realtors annual survey, it's very legitimate, but it has a small response rate, 3.6%, or slightly more than 6,800 responses. Instead, they tapped into the New York Fed's quarterly report on household debt and credit. And I'm sure over the years, David, that you've looked at that data. And it captures about 5% of the population with a credit report, or approximately 14 million individuals. And one important finding is that first-time buyers had a 35% share of all home purchases in 2023. And that was up from 28% in 2013.
All right. I mean, doing better than many had feared is okay. Could have been worse, but it remains hard for renters to buy their first home. I mean, inventories of homes are low, prices are high, mortgage rates are not a bargain.
Not at all. I mean, I think this is the case of the economic glass is half full. I mean, look, first-time home buyers are faring better than expected, but in a market that's difficult for everyone.
All right, but back to these resilient first-time home buyers. How did the successful buyers pull it off?
Well, the economists emphasize two trends. First, average credit scores for first-time home buyers rose by nearly 10%. So that improved them, helped them maintain access to mortgages with decent interest rates. They also found that these first-time home buyers, they went to lower-income zip codes, lower-income neighborhoods, to find houses selling at a cheaper price.
Marketplace's senior economics contributor, Chris Farrell. He's in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Marketplace's David Brancaccio with that interview. Our executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Our digital team includes Antoinette Brock, Emily McCune, and Dylan Mietnin. Our engineers are Brian Allison, Rachel Breeze, and Tessa Block. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It is a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. Thanks so much for your support. Patchy fog early this morning, gradually becoming partly cloudy by the afternoon. Highs near 79. Winds from the west-northwest 10 to 20. For tonight, mostly clear, lows in the mid-50s, and for tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s, and looking ahead to Sunday, slight chance of showers, partly sunny, highs in the low to mid-60s with breezy northwest wind.